Welcome to Laptop Radio. Today's topic is multi-chain application, cross-chain communication, and cooperation instead of competition. We have Sheldon Gere with us. He is a technical lead at Octopus Network. Hello, Sheldon.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us. I'm really excited about today's talk. First of all, let us know your story.
Sure. So I've been just really, really into technology since I was very young. I built my first computer when I was 6, and then I had a lot of devices that people were throwing away to tear apart and to play with and to learn about. And while I was kind of playing with smaller electronics, I was also playing with Windows XP to figure out what every little thing I could toggle was or Boolean value I could change. And I eventually got into what I would call resource hardening, to the point where I'm slimming down operating systems to make them more useful for the thing that I want to use them for. I was doing that at a young age and also working on a lot of different things in music, playing different instruments. And time for the old collegiate decision came around. And my family and I kind of went down this route of like, oh, you're so great with music. Won't you go to school for music? And I said, oh, well, why not? And I found a really good music program downtown Miami, and that's where I was at New World School of the Arts for quite a few years. If you graduate from there, you get a degree from UF. But right before I graduated, I decided it was more important to get into the industry. And all the while, I was doing my own side business for technology integrations, helping people with small business stuff, consumer grade stuff. It used to be a really big deal to get Wi-Fi printing working. Not really such a challenge, but something I could make some money on. I was in this space for quite a while, and then 2009 rolled around, and while I was just getting into the job market, I read the Bitcoin white paper, and I said, wow, this is really, really great. I love this concept. I think that based on what I've seen politically up to this point, this isn't going to survive. I hope it does. And I kind of put it down and almost forgot about it. And then years later, 2013, I had moved to another state. I had moved to Austin for work and for music. And I started getting into corporate IT over there because the music industry just doesn't pay. And being in corporate IT over there, I was asked to remove CoinHive, this old just in-tab browser, Monero miner and Bitcoin miner. I was asked to root this out of a corporate environment, and learning how evasive Bitcoin had become and how hard it was to sort of nail these things down, it just reignited all my passion from reading the 2009 Bitcoin white paper. And I've been participating relatively actively in crypto ever since. Now, between that smaller period in roughly 2013, 2014, I did mine Bitcoin for a short while. I was kind of crushed when someone deleted my private keys. It's a long story. But in that period between 2014 and 2016, basically all I did was read and lab things out and play around. And I wasn't very active in community. But right before the ICO period rolled around, I had people asking lots of questions. Hey, I know you've tried this stuff. Can you tell me about this? And it was really a joy to be able to use what I had learned to help others. I went through a pretty long period of just smell testing ICOs. That was the main thing that I was asked every day, multiple assets. Hey, please do an evaluation of this, investigate this. And I did that for a while, and that kind of converted into gem hunting during the bear market, leading me to get into some really interesting assets like Matic and Constellation before they were really understood by the market. I didn't make large investments in those things because I just sort of did my research and thought they were good and provided that research to others. And it turns out those were some good products. I sort of moved through the industry just being known for doing that sort of stuff. And when I say being known, I mean mostly in smaller communities. Just if I'm very active over a period of time, you tend to get used to me. And yeah, I turned that usefulness into a greater degree of research, started playing with Rust a little bit, started playing with Solidity a little bit, to the point where in the end of 2019, I was pretty frequently doing response and helping people with Solidity audits. I got my sort of taste of security, and I wanted to go a little deeper into that, but it also felt like a sort of an imbalanced judgment to say, okay, I see that Ethereum's hot right now. I'm going to invest my career in this. Lots of developers feel this way. Technology moves fast. It's easy to get caught up. I stopped focusing on Ethereum as much and started looking around to see what else was interesting. I found Substrate. I found Cosmos SDK and Tendermint. And I found a handful of other people innovating with things like DAGs and trying interesting structures for blockchains, for distributed networks. lucky me, around, let's say, what was it, August 2021, after having reviewed the project a few months before and giving a glowing recommendation and review, my peer, Aaron, he asked me to join Octopus Network and to just support by doing some of the things I was already doing, scrutinizing different projects, sort of doing investigations, and then helping manage technical partnerships and doing a little bit of dev relations. I have kind of expanded my role a little bit. I'm very proud that the week before last, I left my day job at Charles Schwab as an IT security manager and IT service person analyst, if you will. I left that job in order to go full-time with Octopus Network. So I've been just really enjoying my time for the past 2 weeks. There was plenty of stuff going on that I'll blab about another time. But yeah, I'm finally just now both feet into the crypto space, and I'm just so glad I can be here, and I'm just happy to help others who are building. That's my mission.
What is Octopus Network?
Octopus Network is a multi-chain concept designed to help the little guy launch an application-specific blockchain. Today, when people think about this structure, they might think about Cosmos, they might think about Polkadot. These are ecosystems that we take inspiration from, and in some cases, borrow technology from and have relationships with. But these other structures, they have inflationary economies with burn mechanisms. They have this sort of elastic status quo that is designed to last ongoing. And that means that they're sort of a one-size-fits-all economy. Someone needs to use their governance token to stake, to delegate, to do an operation. That's great, but it's designed for them to grow from something to something more. The Octopus Network model is that there is not a real bottom floor for Polkadot in particular, but for Substrate in general, that says, hey, you've met a minimum viable concept. You should be able to make it into production. You should be able to provide the value with the work you've already done to others. It's a very quick thing to want to sort of monetize, to want to get into an active economy in crypto. And sometimes waiting an extended period of time either kills that project or makes it more vulnerable or ends up with some sort of derivation from the vision. So the purpose of Octopus Network is to help as many Substrate chains who meet that base level of minimum viable concept launch so that they can eventually reach a higher level, which means either becoming their own Substrate ecosystem, joining Polkadot, or just becoming a sovereign chain that people want to interact with. It's a bit of an easy thing to say, oh, layer zero, and we're a multi-chain economy and all this. But Octopus Network has a specific purpose to help the little guy. And that specific purpose is to say, hey, we have a bunch of resources, we have tools and abilities, we have technology that we've developed. We want to give this away to make sure that the Web3 space is built out in earnest by people who have good ideas today, not by venture capital, the sort of rallying for tomorrow.
Also, how do you first learn about blockchain?
That would definitely be the Bitcoin white paper in 2009. I was familiar with the concept of distributed computing before that, but I really didn't explore it.
Wow, that's pretty early.
I'm happy that I get to sort of like tout that, but also I looked at it and said, wow, this is great. There's no way that the powers that be will let this thing happen. And I didn't understand it well enough to know that you could run this thing through nation state firewalls. I remember that was one of my points of research in 2013 when I was on that sort of offensive defensive engagement to root out mining from a corporate environment. I learned that people were mining Bitcoin in China through Winsocks connections. They were effectively making tunnels to get through the Great Firewall of China to operate this distributed database. I thought that was really, really fascinating.
Was that your aha moment about the blockchain ecosystem?
I'd say so. I was on the fence about wanting to get back into it and about its viability. And I thought, okay, maybe this is cool. Maybe it produces some value. I've heard about ransomware and Monero. I'm not sure that that's viable, et cetera. And I was kind of uncertain on how I should think about it or accept it without jumping to conclusions. What's a viable overarching message I can think about this technology? I was a little bit slow to walk up to that because I knew I was walking into a plethora of things I didn't understand. And as soon as I started doing the dirty work and sort of understanding what kind of peering relationships Bitcoin miners have and different things like that, I was immediately like, okay, so what would it cost for a giant Congress of nation states to get together and say, hey, we want to block this evasive network protocol from our networks. We want to eliminate the ability for people to mine cryptocurrency. Between seeing the very, very high cost that that would be back in the day, it's even higher now, versus that Winsocks implementation of seeing IP addresses that I can't see on the regular internet showing up in these lists that were Chinese network IP addresses, I was absolutely inspired. That was a really big moment for me.
The topic is multi-chain applications, cross-chain communication. Let's start talking about multi-chain application. When you refer to multi-chain, what do you mean?
There is lots of applications today that are sort of based on EVM. They'll say, okay, you can log in with Ethereum MetaMask. You can log in with your address from Polygon. You can log in with your address from, I don't know, or something else. I think that there's a lot of viability around that because it makes it easy to say, okay, I know this address format. I know these basic structures. I'm using Web3JS or whatever, some structure that's familiar to me. I have some sympathy for that. And I do think it still sort of caters to the multi-chain experience in that you're exposed to multiple economies and there's lots of different other tokens and other systems you can be touching and reaching from there. But I think the sort of consideration for this is, where do I need value and where do I need tools? To say that you can just build everything on Ethereum isn't necessarily not correct, but it's usually not the right fit for most applications. I've talked to a lot of applications, especially in the last 6 months, who are looking at something like, hey, Ethereum is great and familiar. There's lots of money there waiting for something to do. I want to be present on the sort of grandfather of smart contracts. I want to be there because everyone's there. But then they also say, okay, I have these other needs. It looks like I'm going to have to do them off chain. I'll have to find some other solution to make these things make more sense because they don't scale real well on Ethereum. For instance, uploading an actual image file, it's more than expensive. It's a pain because you have to split it into smaller pieces most of the time and then reunite them later. That's not a cost that makes sense. It's not a user experience that's worthwhile. It's just not what Ethereum was made for. The direction I'm usually taking on these things is based on like appropriate use case and resource management. If you're trying to specifically store files, then maybe an IPFS network is the best thing for you to use. Maybe you need some sort of distributed storage that isn't quite decentralized. Maybe just local storage for the user is enough for you. There's different ways of going about this, but I've been seeing it more and more as a sane response to, okay, these blockchains do these things really well. We shouldn't ask them to host, let's say, a JPEG just because they can. For instance, if the listener's not familiar, most JPEGs today that are on NFTs are not hosted on chain because it's not really cost effective to do.
How about cross-chain communication? I just feel like it's such a security threat sometimes to have cross-chain, even though it's very efficient and there's less gas fees, or it could be less gas fees.
There's really three main types of bridges. There's the liquidity-based bridging that we know from back in the day. You give me $5, I have $5 available for you on another chain. I then give you the $5 on the other chain. Pretty straightforward. There's also the sort of validator model of bridging, where there might be a relay chain or an intermediary chain that knows about both blockchains, can keep an eye on both of them, and then is able to sort of push a token to one side that had existed on the other side after you locked it up in my custody, let's say. The third one that I really want to focus more time on that I think is significantly more valuable is light client-based interactions. That's an easier, it's a kind of a watered down way to describe a light client is a simple implementation, as few bytes as possible, so that you can sort of teach one chain to speak to another. When you are operating in very different software languages and you're dealing with different consensus models, where in one case, consensus may take place every 6 seconds, in the other case, it may take place every 2, it's sort of tough to keep in touch with these things. And it requires a lot of error correction, patience on the part of the protocol, sort of a different way of approaching network connections, but also very familiar to SYN-ACK, the way we're used to in traditional networking, which is like, okay, let me send a message and then wait to make sure that you received my message. Then I can send another message. I have confirmation that you've received the previous one. Now we can keep talking. I think that that's the most productive because the first two models of bridging, they require that you trust a third party, which is where the majority of those security problems come from. If you're operating between two chains, now granted, there is a third party who designed the light client, but at the same time, there isn't a long-term operational third party. There's not someone who's running a chain between the two chains. There's not someone who's maintaining a big pile of money in between the two chains. It's a very different relationship. I think the most common thing today is sort of the validator bridge model. The liquidity bridge model might be sort of integrated with some validator models. Sometimes you see a hybrid, but it's not common today to say, okay, I'll trust you because you have $1 billion in liquidity and I'm counting on you to just move between the two chains. This is not a great long-term security thing. And of course, there's lots of hacks I could cite recently that sort of exploited this model. If you're custodying $100 million in a smart contract, it's probably worth some money for me to attempt to attack that smart contract. Yeah, I'm definitely a big fan of caution when bridging between chains. And of course, taking precautions for that is very hard to do if you're not technical. But asking the question of how does this bridge work is sort of the mandate we have for anyone who's being cautious. And frequently, that's not going to turn into a big, long technical discussion, but it should explain roughly, okay, when you move the funds here or when you move the tokens here, this is the next action that takes place in order to make that possible on the far end or on the other chain. I am hopeful that this will improve more in the future. We're at Octopus very, very convinced that IBC is the initial sort of handshake and bridging mechanism that'll make this possible. To that degree, we help IBC come up between Polkadot and Cosmos. That's a grant that we're fulfilling right now. We're supporting other organizations like DataChain who are working on Hyperledger and Ethereum IBC Lite clients. The inter-blockchain communication model is something that we genuinely believe in, and that is the effective light client model that says, hey, if I use a semi-universal language, if I teach one chain to talk to another chain, there's no reason they can't exchange fungible assets, and they don't necessarily need a third party or an intermediary to do that. That's mostly my angle. There's a lot more to it in the category of being careful and security. But in the context of design, that's the main thing to look out for. Is the bridge design that you need to trust that third party ongoing? Or is that trust that you establish saying, okay, they've built a tool on both of these blockchains. The tool seems to work. This should be fine.
What is the difference between cooperation and competition in the space, especially when you are allowing multi-chain and cross-chain? How would you structure that so that it is cooperative and not competitive?
Sure. It can be tough to align on things that we're all trying to do. I'll speak about my personal piece and personal choice in that category later. But the initial points of competition are just a sort of race for capital. When Ethereum launched, there wasn't a lot of other places where capital could live and then extend to other places or extend to other use cases or projects. Tokenization on top of Bitcoin was still very young. There was lots of other chains, but they were kind of operating in silos. It's a much more overt thing when you can bridge between the chains to say, hey, I want to take certain actions on my chain to encourage capital, to encourage people to come over from where they are in their existing status quo to use their money in my infrastructure, to apply their funds in ways that are either useful for them or me or somebody else. In a different ecosystem than they've already been established in. Aligning on really any incentive has that initial barrier of everybody wants capital on their chain because it makes them seem stronger, it helps build trust, it helps fund operations in some way. That initial problem usually gets pushed down pretty quickly in a bearish period or in a bear market because all of a sudden the question isn't how big can I balloon this capital, it's how much capital can I stabilize, hold on to, prevent losses on, encourage that it's still worth building in my ecosystem, et cetera. So the logic on capital is always relatively aggressive because the mindset of the one chain to rule them all hasn't really been culturally ironed out yet. I think most people in technology, they would agree that there is no one chain that should do everything. Bitcoin is a great store of value, but it is not the ultimate world computer that should be taught to do everything. Most people rely on that little word should because it's possible to just stack layers on top of Bitcoin and trust the Bitcoin consensus, but it's not resource efficient to just link to that and then make structures that say, okay, I'm a completely different thing from Bitcoin, but because I keep in pace with Bitcoin's consensus model, you can trust me. It was long ago, I don't want to say decided, but sort of like flushed out that, hey, there are other possibilities, there's other ways of doing this. And that's not just Cosmos SDK, that's not just Substrate software. There's lots of other ways that thing and useful distributed computer systems can be used to support economies of human value. That sort of initial sort of capital problem, I'd say, is the context for the rest of these statements, because that's kind of why the status quo is still the way it is. Now, in Substrate, in Bitcoin, I think in Cosmos as well, there's a desire to have multiple implementations. Rust, Golang, JavaScript, or in the case of Ethereum, Solidity, there's lots of overlap between underlying software languages between these different infrastructures. And that means that on the one hand, they don't want to align, like we said, capital motivations. But on the other hand, developers who are looking to build in these places, they're looking around saying, okay, I have refined this skill. Is this skill limited to this ecosystem? If you learn a software language specifically for one company, you know that that is work that does not really benefit you directly when you leave that company or outside that organization. The overlap of languages, the overlap of technologies that people are otherwise already familiar with, whether that's MetaMask or something even more simple like a wallet. These concepts are still relatively young, but they're common motivations. When I talk to wallet providers about taking in token formats that are applicable to the ecosystem at Octopus Network, I'm frequently approaching them and saying, hey, these are the tokens that we would need you to onboard, these formats to support our ecosystem, but these tokens are also in use in these other places. It's important that I show them that the value isn't just limited to me, that they aren't just looking for sort of my grant funding to show up and make it make sense for them to adjust their business model to keep supporting these wallets ongoing, because these are softwares that change. Establishing one time that you have a centralized exchange and you are now able to host Ethereum transactions or host some sort of common Tendermint chains transactions, it doesn't mean that it won't require work. It means that it will require work later. That's the sort of, in to be concise, big item number two is cross-compatibility between technologies that people are working on to build the space. Very straightforward reason for having a relationship there. The last one is kind of a counterpoint to point number one, which is that there can always be more capital. Capital can move around. Capital can be synthesized. There's all kinds of different things that can happen between chains in the capital sense. But this larger need of chains to cooperate in bearish periods, especially, it's obvious, having a series of islands isn't nearly as useful as an archipelago filled with bridges and networks and ferries and paths between them. The idea that we would somehow build this one greatest thing ever and then it would take over the world is kind of based on people trying to see digital assets as Bitcoin 2.0. And for the most part, the crypto industry has moved beyond this concept. Bitcoin is Bitcoin. You can clone it. You can borrow ideas from it. But to say that you can match its value by borrowing some of its code, it's just not true. It's been in production for, what, 12 years now, 11 years? That's the proof. That's the validation that Bitcoin is worthwhile. You can't show up in year one and say, hey, look, we've made some slight modifications. This is worth all of the capital and time. In this way, the sort of like capital problem, this sort of like capital bar fight, if you want to call it, or siloing, the only way I see this being resolved is by more technologists coming in to sort of communicate with people operating capital to illuminate what it means to balance resources really well. To balance resources really poorly is a straightforward and easy thing. You take any tool that can do anything and you ask it to do everything, right? But that's not what really makes sense long-term, especially with distributed computing, because you have to make things so efficient that they make sense for not thousands of people, but for millions or billions of people. To that end, yeah, I think the most important of the three is that sort of capital pivoting to technologists or capital pivoting to a better understanding of technology. And that understanding is not that, hey, I'm not going to bet on this one startup that is the thing to change the world. I'm going to bet on this structure and this concept because it produces in a genuine manner.
Awesome. Let's talk about fairness a little bit. What is fairness to you?
That's a tough one to answer concisely.
I like to define terms so that the listeners understand what they mean when they're listening to us.
I dig it. It absolutely makes sense. So fairness can be a capital device. Fairness can be a control device. I think if I had to zoom out, I would say it's based on who has what power and why. If the three of us, you, me, and a third party, are in some sort of relationship and we all are supposed to have equal power, we're all supposed to have equal voting power, or we all have exactly one third of a treasury that we're managing and we're responsible for it, anything. In this example, we have supposedly equal power. That's not necessarily an exemplification of fairness, and that's not necessarily equal fairness, because while your third of the treasury may have certain controls over, let's say, the front end of an application that we're building together, if my third of the treasury is over the back end and I decide to misappropriate my costs to someone who's going to operate our server and sure, but also pay me out on the side, we're still operating in fairness because I'm still doing what I'm supposed to do with my share of the treasury. And you're still providing what you're supposed to provide with your share, but I'm getting an extra cut that I'm not supposed to get. That will seem and feel unfair to a regular person because I have sort of taken what advantages I can out of a power-oriented scenario and said, okay, I had the power to not just find someone who would host our servers and run our code, but I found someone who would do it at such a low cost that I can take a cut. This is a tough thing to manage because I'm the one who has the ability to move this money. You don't necessarily have the power to make me move the money. There isn't necessarily an organization like a government that can tell me, oh, hey, you're not allowed to do this. You're going to go to jail if you do this. So there's sort of lack of enforcement in a lot of cases today, but that leads us back to the question, like you were saying, of what is fairness? It's highly, highly contextual. And in my opinion, it's about the value that each person is able to extract and affect in a system with other people. If I'm an island unto myself and I have a one person blockchain, which is kind of silly, but let's say I own 10 servers and they're in my 10 houses across 10 states, that doesn't mean that I have a model to be unfair to myself. It means that I don't have anyone else to sort of be fair with. I run and control everything. I have the total power here. There's not a consideration for me to be fair to my pet or something. It's just not a thing. In this way, every person who participates in an economy that I'm either responsible for or also participating in, these relationships that I form with them are usually based on economic interests first, but the secondary interest or one that I find more critical is direct control over systems. If I am one of three treasurers who has the power to touch our smart contract, but let's say you and the other third party don't, then I would say that even though our funds were allocated fairly, our power is not allocated fairly at all. That ability to control, that ability to affect a structure that I share with other people, the way that I do that in context with their interests, I believe that is the definition of fairness. It's how much am I willing to be understanding of these other places where participation is required. I need other people to exist and do stuff to completely stamp out their interests and say, this is my best interest. It means that I'm eliminating a consideration for fairness. I think I could dig into it a little bit more, but I think that's a pretty reasonable suggestion to say that it's contextual relative to the power of people around you.
Yeah. And then there are different features that could use it to ensure that something is fair and then the leverage is distributed, I guess, especially for Web3. I have a question about Octopus. What are some partnerships this would seek?
That's an interesting question because we tend to make a lot of friends and a lot of them don't turn into technical partnerships. We look for partnerships that are good for growing ecosystems together. That means if you want to build a substrate chain, but you don't want to build it with its own independent value proposition, and you want to build it as a bridge between all the other chains, what you've done is effectively set up that validator model that we were talking about before. You're asking other people to get in the middle or to trust this third party in the middle and then move between chains. This isn't a true way to stitch ecosystems together. It's just a cute way to sit at the middle of a round table and say, hi, I'm important, talk to me. We've been looking for partnerships across Ethereum, across the Dotsama, Polkadot, and Kusama ecosystem, and also Cosmos very frequently, because that's the place where we found the most people who are sort of looking at this internet of money or internet of value concept, where there's a lot more to do than just enriching this island that we're on. The silos that we're sort of operating in today, they will be much, much more valuable when there is interaction between them. That's where our partnerships focus for the most part is either, can it enrich our ecosystem or can it enrich the larger ecosystem that we want to participate in, which is an ecosystem of ecosystems. And those projects are fairly rare. Their work is usually pretty innovative. Their work is usually not well appreciated by venture capital because it's frequently not tokenized. When you're trying to set up infrastructure that operates between multiple blockchains, it's not always the best idea to pop up and say, hey, let's have a token. Sometimes that means that you're anchored to one chain. Sometimes that means your economy is always bound to one spot. It's a tough sell to say, hey, I want to help build the blockchain future as a cryptocurrency future, but also I only want to build on this chain. It's kind of narrow. Most of the partnerships that we're looking for are either to the enrichment of our ecosystem, like I was saying, or to the enrichment of the larger multi-chain ecosystem.
Is there anything that you wanted to share that I have not asked you?
In a polite as possible way as I can to not be pitchy, we do really want to help the little guy. That is my personal mission. That's part of the design of how we work at Octopus. If there's people out there who are building small concepts and they're not sure if they need their own chain, or they're looking at just living on one chain and realizing what it means to need IPFS and a front end and local storage and secondary key management and all kinds of complex things, I want to encourage people out there, if you're building something and you want to build something that stands both on its own, but in concert with others together, please talk to us. Even if you don't necessarily build with our solution, we'll be happy to support you. There are a handful of organizations out there that are not building on our solution, that are not sort of directly enriching the ecosystem of ecosystems, but are indirectly a huge benefit. That ecosystem of ecosystems value means if you feel like you don't have a home and you're doing something that benefits the larger crypto market, and that is a distributed and decentralized thing, not anchored to your local jurisdiction, please come talk to us. Odds are good. We'd love to support you.
What is one piece of advice that you have for the community?
If I had to narrow it down to just one, I would say end the bar fight. I would say be ready to tear down silos. I would say build social bridges. I'm really just saying the same thing in different ways, but this sort of we are one community, we are together, it's not really kumbaya. It's a much more logical presentation of liquid capital and integrative technologies. On the one hand, there is the bar fight that we were sort of illuminating earlier, where everyone builds on their own and wants to be the best thing ever. But on the other hand, there's people like us at Octopus Network. We genuinely believe in this sort of motivation to do what's right for crypto, do what's right for humanity, do what makes the most sense for all of us at scale.
Where can people find you?
Today, I am back in my hometown of Miami. I was in Austin for about 10 years, and I still keep up my apartment there. I do plan on visiting Austin on occasion. I am out in the community local in Miami, but I'm getting more active on Twitter. You can find me, ARTUSLETON, on Twitter. Also, if you tweet at the main Octopus Network account and you see someone really nerdy responding to you, that is me. I am more than happy to help with weird questions. If you want a war game stuff, if you say, hey, I heard about this. What the heck is this? I've been a researcher for long enough, or I've already heard of it and done some research, or I can quickly do some for you and give you a reference. I do not mind doing that.
Beautiful. Thank you, Sheldon.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I appreciate you having me on.
Of course. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.